Hi, everyone, and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. This is our third annual Autism Conference. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. A little housekeeping here. If you're using the Internet to participate, you can go to the blue box on your screen and click Slides to view the slideshow. Synchronize your slides with either your phone or the webcast audio, however you're listening, by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. And be sure to mute your computer if you're listening via phone so you don't get an echo. There's also a box where you can submit a question, so please do so as we go along here. Submit your questions. No question is stupid, so go ahead and ask away. If you're using your telephone to participate, you can ask a live question by pressing star 2, and that'll connect you directly to, well, I will give you permission to be connected directly to the presenter to ask your questions. Today, we have with us Dr. Carl Hillier, and he is speaking on mirror neurons, embodied cognition, and vision, new discoveries and new thinking regarding the role that vision plays in autism. A little bit about Dr. Carl Hillier. He is an OD and an FCOVD, and he can explain to us later what that is, of the San Diego Center for Vision Care. He graduated from the University of California, San Diego in 1977 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology. He received a Bachelor of Science degree at Pacific University in 1980 and then graduated as a Doctor of Optometry in 1982. He is a fellow in the College of Optometrists in Vision Development. Dr. Hillier is an adjunct clinical professor at the Southern California College of Optometry and Illinois College of Optometry. In 1992, Dr. Hillier helped found the Vision Rehabilitation Clinic at the San Diego Rehabilitation Institute at Alvarado Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Hillier.
Thank you, Nancy. It's nice to be here. Well, I appreciate being given the opportunity to talk about these topics, especially surrounding vision and some of the new discoveries in cognitive neuroscience that surrounds vision and how they might relate to those with autism. You had mentioned in the introduction, maybe I could explain what FCOVD means after
yes, please.
My name. That's referring to a fellow in the College of Optometrists and Vision Development.
Thank you.
The College of Optometrists and Vision Development is a professional organization dedicated to furthering their knowledge and clinical expertise in the areas of child development, brain injury, and rehabilitation. So it's a group of professional optometrists that have dedicated themselves to pursue that aspect of vision care. So I am excited to talk about this field because there's so much going on now in regards to vision and autism and vision and child development in general. And so I wanted to be able to share some of these things that scientists are discovering about this role that vision's playing in autism and how these new aspects of cognitive neuroscience in regards to mirror neurons and embodied cognition relate to all of that. So I'd like to start out by maybe just reviewing what vision is, because as many people know, there's a myth in our culture, in our society, that 20/20 is perfect vision. And it used to be thought that having 20/20 eyesight and healthy eyes was sufficient for normal child development to occur. But what we know today is that the visual skills necessary for learning go far beyond the ability to see 20/20. The Snellen chart that you see in your pediatrician's office and at the school nurse's office, that is that chart that has the big E that goes all the way down to the small letters on the bottom, that was developed around the time of the Civil War, around 1865 or so. And unfortunately, what happens is that many people still feel that perfect vision is the ability to see the smallest letter on that chart, or at least close to the smallest letter, which is a 20/20 letter. And all that really means is that an individual can see small things far away. And it means nothing about their ability to process what they're seeing, to interact with what they're seeing, to remember what they see. It says nothing about how much effort's involved in being able to see. So that's really a test that causes lots of confusion and misunderstanding amongst parents and other professionals. because of this ongoing myth that 20/20 is perfect vision. And it's very cruel, actually, for a child to be told that they have 20/20 eyesight and that their vision's fine, when in fact they might have several visual issues that are interfering with optimal development, whether it be in athletics or academics. Even social situations can be affected when there's an interference within the visual system. So I thought that I wanted to clear the air there as to what vision is not. Perfect vision is not 20/20. So let's take a look then at some of the visual skills that are necessary for normal development. And I'll be going through about 3 or 4 slides here to really emphasize the significance of some of these other skills that are absolutely crucial for children, whether you're on the autistic spectrum or not, to have in order to interface with the environment that you are in. And primary to all these skills is probably eye movement control. That is, the ability to move your eyes when and where you want to. There's 3 aspects of eye movement control that developmental optometrists study and investigate during their clinical evaluations. Number 1 is fixations, the ability to maintain steady focal fixation on a particular object in their visual environment. That is, to be able to sustain alignment on that target long enough to derive meaning from it. And that's one of the most critical skills, is to actually volitionally choose to move the eyes to a certain point in space, whether that be a book or dynamic three-dimensional space around you in an athletic event or in a social situation where you might want to identify certain people in your social field. That is, the ability to stay fixated, to look there long enough to derive meaning from what the eyes are pointed at. A second skill, which is related to fixations, is pursuits. Pursuits are the ability to follow a smooth-moving target or to move your body through space and be able to sight a stationary target as you move past it. So a pursuit skill enables us to know when and where things will be as they move by us, or when and where we will be as we move by them. So the pursuit system is very, very involved in a child's feeling confident and secure in time and space. Saccades are the eye movements that we use for reading. It may seem as though when we're reading we might be smoothly moving our eyes along a line of print from left to right, and that's our perception of it, of course. But in reality, it's more like a typewriter. Those of us old enough to know what it's like to use a typewriter. The eyes make these discrete movements from left to right. They stop, they fixate, they gather a certain amount of information. Then with sufficient peripheral visual skills, they move. The eyes move to the next group of words, stop, fixate, process that information, then move to the next word or group of words, depending on the skill level and experience level of the child. They move along that line of print in that saccadic method. So there's a series of saccades. And so during an examination, that's critical that these 3 types of eye movements are closely evaluated. And the fixations, pursuits, and saccades are all well and good, but we also have to make things clear. So accommodation is the ability to control when the images are clear. So images aren't simply automatically clear to us. There's a very involved muscular sequence of events and neurological sequence of events that has to happen in order for images that we do fixate on for them to become clear, and that's called accommodation. So when we shift focus from far to near, the muscles inside of our eyes, based on the neurological input to the eyes, change the shape of the lens inside of our eye to cause things to be close in focus, and then to recapture distance focus and back and forth. And given that this is a muscle, it requires skill and development. It can also result in fatigue. So there's ways that we can assess that skill, and that is by ensuring that there's good clarity far and near. Colin, I'm getting a low battery. So I'm getting a low battery. So I'm just checking on my phone here, making sure that I can sustain this conversation. I got a little bit of low battery here. So can you still hear me, Nancy?
Yes.
Okay. So accommodation is the ability to ensure that things maintain good clarity, far and near. And that's absolutely critical. And then finally, we get to eye teaming. And eye teaming, in terms of neuromuscular skills, are really important as well. Okay. Can you still hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. And so eye teaming is the ability for the eyes to work synchronously as a team. That is, when both eyes look into the distance or both eyes look close up or we're tracking along a line of print or we are scanning our three-dimensional environment, if both eyes aren't pointed exactly in the same spot, then what's going to result is double vision or an unreliable focus of vision or possibly even a lack of depth perception. And one of the most difficult things for children to contend with is when their three-dimensional world shifts into a two-dimensional world. And that can cause a lot of apprehension and uncertainty for kids, especially in novel situations. So when a child walks into a new environment, if they aren't using both of their eyes together at the same time, or if they are able to do this only intermittently, then what will happen is that child will experience the world to be three-dimensional, then back to two-dimensional, then possibly three-dimensional, or they might see the world to be double or single. So this area of binocularity is absolutely essential to assess, and it's not often assessed in vision screenings. So a real comprehensive examination is important there for kids along the spectrum, as well as anyone else, any other neurotypical child. And then what we do is we move on to visual perception. Visual perception is an absolutely important part of the visual system. It's what ultimately enables us to derive meaning from the world. Visual perception, first of all, enables us to see distinctions between things. That is, one object is different than another. That's the beginning of being able to learn to categorize and to develop spatial awareness, to learn that things can be sequenced in a certain pattern. And ultimately, this is what written language is all about. That is the ability to see a sequence of language symbols in a certain spatial array in the book. And this can't occur unless there's the primary foundation of intact visual perceptual skills. Some of these visual perceptual skills we're all familiar with, such as figure ground or visual closure, size constancy, visual discrimination, like I mentioned before, spatial relations and things of this nature. But without visual perception, we can't begin to derive meaning from the world around us. And part of visual perception, sometimes it's thought of the visual cognitive system, involves visual memory. Visual memory, there's basically three general categories of visual memory that I'd like to talk about. That is declarative memory. This is there's two basic aspects of declarative memory. One is semantic, that is being able to share or reflect on information, linguistic information that, or factual information that we've derived from previous processing of information, whether it be from a book or from conversation. There's also episodic memory, which is declarative in that we can recall activities or scenes that we've been engaged in. So if we go to Disneyland and we have an experience there, we can share that later on with declarative memory, whereas semantic memory would be declaring or sharing some information about something we might have read in a history book or a conversation that we might have had with somebody about a concept. And then there's working memory. Working memory is really one of the most sophisticated cognitive skills that we have, and that is to be able to associate current incoming content with things we already know and to be able to do that while thinking about something else. So a classic example might be while reading a book, we're reflecting on the content of what we're reading as it relates to things we already know and to predicting what might be occurring in the future as we continue to read that book. So it's kind of a parallel processing activity of being able to think about what we're thinking which is sometimes called metacognition. But working memory is also transferring new information into our long-term and short-term memory for future use, and also for predicting future outcomes based on what we're currently experiencing. Procedural memory is basically how to do things. It's more of an implicit kind of memory where it's not necessarily cognitively or consciously driven, I should say. This is, initially it might be cognitively driven, such as learning how to tie your shoes. After a while, though, that just becomes an automatic motor movement, and it's considered a procedural memory. So these are some of the important aspects of vision. And the final one that I would like to review has to do with visual attention in regards to the normal visual skills for normal development that need to be evaluated with most kids, and that is visual attention. Visual attention comes in lots of different flavors as well. We have focused attention, which is the ability to sustain attention on a particular object. That is to be able to find a specific element in our visual world that we want to have continuous cognitive activity with, and very closely related to sustained attention. So focused attention is one particular thing, and amongst a lot of alternatives, and then sustained attention is to be able to endure that cognitive activity for a long period of time. Selective attention is the ability to choose to attend to a particular object in your environment, even though there's competing stimuli in your environment. So there might be noise, there might be lights, there might be movement, other people, smells, things of this nature, but you can selectively attend to one and not let the others interfere with your attention to the one that you choose to attend to. Alternating attention is similar to that, but you can selectively choose from one cognitive set to another. So you might be drawing at one moment and then being able to talk at another moment. Now, a lot of kids can't do this, and a lot of kids get very frustrated with this when they have to be able to alternate their attention from what they're reading to what they're hearing. So having a conversation with somebody or being disrupted when they're reading a book by somebody speaking to them or having the TV on or having the room, having noises in the room be distracting, lights in the room being distracting. So alternating attention is an important skill for maintaining control and behavioral confidence in an otherwise complicated environment. Divided attention is the ability to have simultaneous attention. Now, so divided attention sometimes is considered simultaneous attention, where you are having an ongoing attention with various activities at the same time. So you might be balancing on a ball while having a conversation simultaneously, or you're painting, but you are also having a conversation, or you're balancing on a balance board or something like of this nature. So you're usually engaging in two separate cognitive activities at the same time, but they're not competing, so that you can divide your attention between both of them and still feel comfortable doing that. Are there any questions so far that you have, Nancy, about any of these things? Or
I just wondered, you probably get to this, but I wondered how you evaluate a combative or nonverbal individual.
Well, nonverbal individuals aren't typically a problem at all. Combatives are challenging, but we evaluate both types. A nonverbal individual, the nice thing about a vision analysis is that we don't have to get a lot of vocal responses from our patients to know what they are doing. So we observe their body in response to different challenges that we offer them. So, for example, when a child walks in to our office, we observe how they walk, of course, and depending on how they negotiate the space around them, that gives us a lot of information about their visual input to motor movement. So one of the main reasons of having a visual system is to guide the intelligent movement of the body. And when we see a child, say, for example, toe walking, we can sometimes, we have to make a decision. Is this child toe walking because they have tactile sensitivity, or is it because they have a spatial misjudgment of the world that they're seeing? And we see quite frequently, sometimes up to 20 or 30% of the time, children with toe walking are behaving that way because they see the world to be sloping downward. And when they see the world to be sloping downward, but the fact that it isn't causes them to hit their toes as they walk, and they are kind of leaning forward, using their toes to hit the floor, and they're trying to maintain balance that way. And so that's one observation that we use to learn a little bit more about their spatial awareness. And we can confirm or deny that suspicion of having a spatial challenge by putting on specialized yoked prisms. Yoked prisms are lenses that can move the visual space to a different place relative to their egocentric position, meaning that where they perceive their body to be and where their environment is can be shifted relative to one another through the use of yoked prisms. So we will put yoked prisms on a child, and if they stop toe walking immediately upon putting on these lenses, then we know that they were toe walking because of a visual spatial misjudgment rather than, say, a tactile sensitivity issue with their feet and heels. So that would be one way to evaluate a nonverbal child without having them respond to us, other than just through their overt behavior. Other times we will have, we can determine if a child is nearsighted or farsighted or has astigmatism very easily with a retinoscope, even with a non-cooperative, combative child or nonverbal child, because all that we need to do is use what's called a retinoscope. A retinoscope is an instrument, it's a very sophisticated flashlight that we shine into the eye, and we can do this from a distance of even 10, 20 feet sometimes, and so we don't have to get close to the child. But we can shine this toward the eye, and it's, the light is what's called collimated, and we can see the light bounce into the off of the retina. It reflects back to us into the space of the room, and we observe that reflected light that's coming out of the eye, and from that information we can then determine the refractive status of the child. So it's a very, very effective way to know whether or not the child even has the capacity to see clearly. And that's very important. At the same time, that instrument can let us know if the eyes are aligned or not. If there's a subtle misalignment of the eyes, if there's a binocular dysfunction, if the eyes are crossed or intermittently crossed, if there's amblyopia, which is just as common in autistic children as it is in neurotypical children, which occurs in about 3% of the population, actually, and it's one of the most common causes of childhood blindness there is, which can be identified very quickly, very easily with a non-cooperative or a combative child through the use of what we call retinoscopy or using that retinoscope. So there's lots of different things we can do to evaluate a non-participatory child.
Right.
Over time, we certainly get the child usually feels more and more comfortable in the environment that we're in. Oftentimes, we will send to a parent a video or photographs of our office and the people that they'll see in, to prepare them for where they'll be going, so that it's not too much of a novel experience, and this seems to allay some of their concerns about going into a new place and shifting gears into a new environment, making those kind of transitions.
Okay.
Yeah. So moving on then to these new discoveries, really interesting things going on in the field of cognitive neuroscience. And mirror neurons is what I would like to talk about first, because there's a lot of conversation going on in relationship to mirror neurons and autism. Giacomo Rizzolatti in Italy first discovered these mirror neurons in the early 1990s, and he wrote a book that you might be interested in reading. It's quite readable, even though it's from a neuroscientist. It's called Mirrors in the Brain, How Our Minds Share Actions and Emotions. And basically, what these what this discovery has enabled us to know is that when we observe the movements of others, we can understand the intention of those movements because of our own motor repertoire. So what I mean by that is that when we are capable of moving our bodies in a certain way or our facial muscles in a certain way, we can recognize the intentions of others when somebody else moves their body in that same way. So if somebody's going to pick up a ball, we know they have the intention of maybe picking up that ball and throwing it. But if we don't have that same skill in our bodies to pick up a ball and throw it, we might not know that's the intention of the person we're watching. Mirror neurons are neurons that share two properties. They share sensory properties and motor properties. So it's the same neuron that is firing when we observe the movement of somebody else is the same neuron that will fire when we make that same movement ourselves. And so that's why they call these mirror neurons. And so our motor repertoire enables us to recognize the intentions of others, not only their gross motor movements, but also facial expressions. So if we have a skilled movement repertoire of our facial muscles and being able to exhibit various facial expressions, we can then understand the facial expressions of others much more easily. And, for example, if we see somebody being poked by a stick, our mirror neurons for touch kick in, and we actually can have empathy or almost feel what it would feel like to the person we see being touched as we have that same feeling in ourselves of being touched. This is a very significant finding in cognitive neuroscience because we are social beings, and when we learn through social learning theory, there's a Dr. Bandura, a psychologist from Canada, who came up with cognitive social learning theory, and he talks a lot about how we acquire information surrounding possibly this mirror neuron system. And Dr. Ramachandran here in San Diego and others around the world have been doing electroencephalography studies on children with and without autism to determine whether or not they have fewer functioning, possibly mirror neurons or not. And so it's important to, when we're studying these, to determine, you know, is this really true? Do children with autism have fewer neurons or more neurons than others? So what they did is they found out in their EEG studies that many children with autism have fewer functioning mirror neurons. And this is suggesting that this might be one of the reasons why we are unable to, why children that are autistic are unable to maybe recognize the intentions of others as easily as they might otherwise be able to. But there's been some controversy there as well. So it's important to realize that that may not be the case. But a lot of the studies show that although autistic children do seem to develop mirror neurons at the same rate as those without autism, there seems to be still a shorter population or a fewer population of these mirror neurons interfering with the ability for children to maybe recognize the intentions of others, as well as being able to understand the emotions of others possibly, or the implications of gestures and possibly even spoken language, because many of the researchers that study mirror neurons think that this might be in some way the precursor to gestural language as well as spoken language. So it's a very interesting topic, and I think that more research will be done and we'll learn more and more about it as we go. Can you still hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So that's an exciting field. And I think that we're going to learn more and more about that all the time as we go through this whole sequence. There's some really wonderful methods that are being derived from these discoveries as well clinically. I mean, the research here certainly just enables us to maybe explain some of the behaviors, but the research also generates a lot of ideas to help kids along the autistic spectrum maybe develop better mirror neuron systems and therefore develop better social skills and social learning skills. And one of them is called MeMoves. It's capital M-E, capital M-O-V-E-S. And that's a neat system. We use this in our clinic a lot, and it seems to calm children down. It seems to have them engage and model movements of others in a systematic, balanced, bilaterally coordinated way. And it's a wonderful system. Virtually all of our children along the autistic spectrum that come into our clinic to develop their visual skills use this program to help develop what I think might be more of their mirror neuron system, which I think is a very interesting and innovative way to go. So that's a big deal, the mirror neuron system. And let me talk a little bit now about what, well, here's the attributes. I just put this slide up so you can see what they do. They share emotions. They let us know about what physical objects, how they might be manipulated, how we might be able to move our body to manipulate the objects we see, and to understand the intentions of others. And here's the slide now that talks about how there might be some challenges in terms of some of the data, but I think most researchers realize that there is definitely a relationship between children with autism and possibly a less than optimally functioning mirror neuron system. And this theory of mind, maybe many of you I'm sure have heard of this theory of mind, and that is the ability to understand that others have independent intentions and independent activities and independent thoughts based on, and a lot of this has to do with eye movement control and gaze direction. And this right temporal parietal junction associated with the theory of mind reveals a consistently low activation, a level of activation of mirror neurons. So there's a lot of things that seem to be correlated here in regards to mirror neurons, autistic behavior, and some of these other theories that relate to autism. So the implications here are that, you know, those with lower functioning, fewer functioning mirror neurons, the intentions are not going to be understood by others, emotions may not be understood, empathy to others may not be readily available to them, social learning may be less available, sensory motor integration would be compromised, and gestures and speech may not be well understood. But again, it doesn't mean that these mirror neurons aren't developing, and it doesn't mean that they're not developable, based on some of the research and some of the clinical interventions that are out there to help kids along in this area. So let's move on now to talking a little bit more about embodied cognition. So embodied cognition has the concept that thinking is grounded in the body's interaction in the world. So in other words, we aren't simply minds in our head that simply have a body. It's not like that at all. It's really that our body has a mind and they're interacting in the world. And that body's ability to move and interact in the environment determines our understanding of the world and our ability to interact in it. So the way the body moves can also determine language development. The mind requires a body to make it function. So as a matter of fact, those that are working with artificial intelligence, for example, they've tried and tried and tried to develop computers and other models of thinking computers, but they don't have a body and they can't move. So not until they started equipping computers with sensory and motor aspects, especially visual aspects, were these computers able to behave anywhere near as though they had artificial intelligence. So the way the body moves in the environment determines our understanding and our confidence in that environment. So, for example, when we walk into a space that we're not familiar with, let's say if I were to walk into an art studio and not being an artist, there might be many objects in there that I don't know the function of, and I would barely recognize that they're even in the room. Or I would look at them and they would have no significance to me at all. They'd have no meaning. And I wouldn't be able to consider the relationships of those objects to other things that I might be more familiar with, such as a canvas or a paintbrush. So being able to move into and interact with objects enables us to be able to think about what's there and to be confident with what we see in those novel environments. So if our ability to move through space and our ability to employ simultaneously the multisensory interactions with that environment, we can then ultimately have the visual system look into those novel environments and, based on previous experience with manipulation, auditory, tactual, proprioceptive, vestibular, if later on we walk into an environment that has similar things but we can only see them and we can't tactually or in any other way manipulate those objects, just by seeing them we can revivify our previous multisensory inputs that were associated with the visual target and know the nature of it. So in other words, vision becomes the dominant system for being able to determine what we see in the world, but it's only because we've been able to match our previous sensory motor experiences with what we're seeing. And so embodied cognition is critically dependent upon the visual system's ability to match the body's movement through space, integrate all the sensory input that's available from that, and then be able to later on use vision to see and to understand, to know, and to then be free to conceptualize with more abstract thoughts. So in other words, we're not perceptually bound anymore. We can look at visual information and be free to think about what's there, think about possibilities, because our physical environment's handled. We're secure in the space around us so that we don't have to be vigilant about protecting ourselves. We know when and where things are happening around us, and we don't have to be hypervigilant in that regard to protect ourselves, but rather we can consider more abstract modalities of thinking in order to engage in the environment that we might be exposed to. So embodied cognition is a big deal, and you're going to, I think, see more and more of this when it comes to children along the autistic spectrum. So perception is embedded in the dynamics of action. Cognition or thinking skills exist for actual potential action. So in other words, the body is there to act, to move, and the visual system is the liaison between those two. That is, the visual system is the liaison between the physical world around us and our body's ability to act, and it's that liaison that enables the body to develop a movement repertoire, thus enabling it to understand the nature of the world around us. And cognition takes place in an active reciprocal exchange with the surrounding environment. So we offload cognitive information into the environment. And so we do that with writing, we do that with gesture, we do that with construction, with art, even with music. And so we need to be able to have this active exchange back and forth between the environment and the body to enable the mind to be able to grow and to think more about in more abstract ways, such as language, written language and spoken language. So what do we do from here? I mean, knowing that the visual system involves much more than seeing 20/20, knowing that having healthy eyes in 20/20 is insufficient for normal child development, it's completely insufficient to help children along the autistic spectrum to develop as normally as they possibly can, to learn how to acquire and derive meaning from their environment, whether it be social, athletic, or academic. So what we must do then is there's six things that I've written down here that I think are quite important for everyone to think about. And that is, number one, obtain an eye health evaluation. That's absolutely essential from a visual standpoint. Optometrists, developmental optometrists, ophthalmologists can all do this quite well. Number two, obtain a refractive analysis of the eyes. Again, a nonverbal child, a combative child, a child that is completely irresponsive or non-responsive, is not kept from this full assessment of their refractive status, a determination of their capacity to see clearly, whether or not both eyes are aligned, whether or not they have the likelihood of three-dimensional vision. We can rule out amblyopia. We can determine if they need glasses. And many times, it's absolutely essential. Well, it's amazing to me that many children along the autistic spectrum have not been evaluated just because they've been, quote-unquote, difficult to evaluate, and they can be evaluated. And once they wear glasses, many times many of those autistic behaviors subside because they can now connect more readily with their environment. So number two, obtaining a refractive analysis is available to all kids regardless of their behavior, regardless of their developmental age. So, for example, a four-month-old can have this evaluation done, and it's not a problem, as well as brain-injured adults that can't speak. Number three, establish a thorough evaluation of the five muscular skills necessary to scan the environment and move the body. So remember, there's two reasons for having a visual system, really. One is to derive meaning from the environment around us, from light, and then also to direct the intelligent movement of the body. Directing the intelligent movement of the body enables the mind to grow. So these, number three, these muscular skills are absolutely essential. Number one, comfortable and efficient eye alignment and depth perception skills, the smooth visual pursuit skills that I talked about earlier, the steady visual fixation skills that I mentioned earlier, the skillful visual saccades for searching and scanning that I talked about, and the skillful focusing skills of accommodation. Those are absolutely important for all children. And then finally, number four, obtain a full evaluation of the visual perceptual skills. This would include visual closure, visual discrimination, visual form constancy, visual figure ground, visual closure, I think I mentioned already, so in spatial relations. These are all absolutely important. And then the visual motor aspects, visual motor integration, and then obtain a visual an evaluation of the visual thinking skills, which would include visual memory, all aspects of visual memory, sustained, selective attention, as well as the memory, working memory skills. So without the memory aspects, without the attentional aspects, without the perceptual aspects being evaluated, it's still very difficult to know how we might be able to clinically intervene. First of all, we want to know where that child stands in their development, and then we can develop a treatment plan that incorporates all these different professionals. I think number one amongst these professionals might be an occupational therapist. They are well-versed with sensory integration. They understand child development. Most of them understand primitive reflexes very well, which is essential for driving the initial movement skills of the body into action with their environment. And then certainly a speech and language pathologist or therapist, neuropsychologist, special educators, and developmental optometrists are, I think, probably the least known, maybe amongst these groups, but they are, at least from my perspective, since I am a developmental optometrist, we can be one of the most helpful individuals in reestablishing a nice connection of the child with their environment through the use of lenses, yoked prisms, like I mentioned earlier, with toe walking, and the ability to guide the intelligent movement of the body and to stimulate that mirror neuron system to nurture the embodied cognition skills that are so critical for developing thinking. Now, it's not easy to get this team of people together. in one room, let alone on a conference call. But this is the ideal scene. I think if we had this group of people together in a room talking about your child, you'd have probably the best input possible to derive a treatment plan or a developmental plan for your child so that every opportunity is available to them. These clinicians mentioned there can discuss their findings together openly with everyone present and listening, and a plan can be developed that might not include vision right away. Maybe it's going to be occupational therapy in the beginning. Maybe speech and language is going to heavily emphasize sign language and de-emphasize written language for a while. Or who knows, there's unlimited combinations of therapeutic plans that can be derived from a group of professionals such as this. But I think these are the key players when it comes to being able to make an efficient plan for a child who has autism. Do you have any questions at this point, Nancy?
How many times are you called in on a plan like this?
I am usually the one that initiates this plan. I'm not often called in except for patients that I've already examined. So with patients that I've already examined and with the team of people that I have in San Diego that we currently work with, it's fairly common, but I'm not usually sought out independently of the group that I'm already with. Yeah.
Amy from North Carolina has a question. My daughter is 5, nonverbal, and I've been seeing an eye doctor since she was 1.5. I keep telling him she has to be up close and personal with anything she watches, and he says that she'll outgrow it and that it is an autism thing. What do you think in your opinion?
Well, children, whether they're autistic or not, behave for a reason. They move their bodies for a reason. They turn their heads for a reason. They get close to things for a reason. Everything's for a reason, and I think we need to find out what those reasons are. But the most obvious reason there would be nearsightedness. Now, I can only hope that this eye doctor has ruled that out, that they've done what's called retinoscopy, that they've determined the optics of the eye, in other words, and they know that this child has the capacity to see clearly in the distance. We also need to confirm that this child's eyes can be parallel into the distance, that they're comfortable when the eyes are straight and parallel to look at things in the distance. That is, they're not excessively converging, causing this child to want to get close to prevent seeing double. I would just maybe get a second opinion. It doesn't hurt to do that. I encourage my parents of patients to have a second opinion. It's not a problem, and I think it's your child's development that's at stake here, and if you continually see that kind of behavior, sometimes the quote-unquote autistic thing isn't a sufficient explanation. So I would consider getting a second opinion. Yeah.
Sounds like good advice.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, there's lots of things that happen. There's lots of concerns. There's lots of behaviors that autistic children exhibit when they are when they have a visual issue. As we all know, lots of times children with autism they will grab an object, some keys, and they'll shake the keys, and they'll look out of their peripheral vision. They won't have good eye contact, and these kind of behaviors are sometimes simply autistic behaviors, but also they can sometimes be visually induced behaviors, independent of an autistic reason. So, for example, a child that's always looking out of the corner of their eye may have a binocular imbalance that really makes them much more comfortable when they look away instead of looking directly at things. And that's important to rule out. Is it secondary to a binocular dysfunction? So that's an important aspect, too. So all of these behaviors can be, if they're all assumed just to be simply part of the spectrum of behaviors that are associated with the diagnosis of autism, then there would be no reason to look further. But vision plays such a dominant role in development that we need to look at all these things that I mentioned earlier. 2/3 of all the nerves that enter the brain come from the eyes. So the nervous system has dedicated a huge amount of itself to visual processing. And so when there's an issue in behavior, it could be secondary to a visual input issue or a visual motor output issue. There's just a huge array of possibilities there. And so that's why we have to work in conjunction with so many other professionals, I think, to get the big picture here. So occupational therapy is a big part of our team here in San Diego when we investigate children, because we want to get a really good handle on their vestibular system, for example. A child's vestibular development is what helps nurture eye movement control, focusing ability, binocularity, and ultimately gives the child a sense of understanding where they are in space. It gives them what's called an egocentric knowledge of where their body is in space, so they can then develop what's considered more of an allocentric perspective on the space around them, so they can negotiate space, so they're comfortable moving into novel situations, so they can have a roadmap of where they're going and where they're coming from, and to even think of novel ways to move through the space that they are habitually in. And that's all based on the vestibular system. But if that vestibular system isn't functioning properly, then it's very difficult for the visual system to develop properly. So all of these different clinical services, I think, weave into one each other in a very intimate way. And if I don't have information about vestibular development, or if I don't have information about language development, or if I'm not sure of a child's linguistic cognitive skills, I'm not going to be sure about a lot of things, and I'll make a naive clinical judgment based on vision alone, and that's just not the best way to go. So I think getting input from everyone, and I think most parents with children along the autistic spectrum have met with these professionals before, but the ideal scene, I think, is to get them all together in one room.
Yeah. How much of your practice do you think is devoted to the autism realm?
Well, it's hard to say. It depends on if you're talking about examinations or treatment or consultation. But I would say about 15%, 20% of my practice is helping individuals along the autistic spectrum.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions about anything?
If somebody wanted to find a developmental optometrist in their area or their country, is there like a national database, an international database,
a local database? There's an international database of doctors of optometry that work in the field of autism. And, well, I should say work in the field of child development, kind of a broader sense, and acquired brain injury. Just any aspect of human development, really. And it's called the College of Optometrists and Vision Development. COVD.org would be a website to go to. And you can click on Find a Doctor, and there's doctors all throughout Europe, Australia, Asia, North America, and Canada. So, you can. Now, what I would recommend that you do, though, is that not all doctors in this organization specialize in autism. So, it's important to call them and interview them on the phone and find out to what extent they do work with children that have autism. And that way, you would better understand whether or not you're going to a clinic that can help serve your child best. And some of the questions you might ask are, do you do a full battery of near-point tests to determine neuromuscular control of the eyes in regards to saccades, pursuits, fixations, accommodation, binocularity, like I discussed earlier, and then ask them if they do a full battery of visual perceptual tests, including visual memory, visual attention, and then ask them whether or not they do any treatment, and if they don't treatment, would they refer out to treat do they have a referral, a clinic that they refer to for treatment? But those are good questions to ask, and I think it's important to interview the clinician before you go there. Otherwise, you're going to hear back, probably not from somebody from COVD.org, but if you go to a standard clinic, you're going to hear back that the child's eyes are healthy, that they see 20/20, and the conversation's over with. And I think that's when a parent should start to get a little bit upset, because there's a lot more to the conversation than just 20/20 and eyes healthy. It's absolutely critical that we look at those other things. I mean, two-thirds of the brain wouldn't be dedicating itself to vision if it wasn't more important than just seeing clearly and having healthy eyes. Half of the cranial nerves are dedicated to the optimal development of vision. Vision and language and movement are so intimately interrelated that it's almost hard to separate them. And, you know, you need a comprehensive assessment, and you also need a written report. I would ask these clinicians that you're considering having your child brought to whether or not they will provide a full written report. Will they have a conference with you, possibly independent of the child, in order to have a conversation, an in-depth conversation about the relationship of vision to the development of their child? And that's absolutely critical. So going into a doctor's office for 10 minutes or 20 minutes, having the eyes dilated and leaving with the report that the eyes are 20/20 and that the eyes are healthy is really a disservice to the child and to the family.
That's what I've encountered.
Well, that's what most parents encounter, and it's
yeah.
unfortunate because, again, we have this myth in our culture that 20/20 is perfect vision and that that's all there is to it, when it's just simply not the case. It's just it's a real cruel, real misleading myth that our culture seems to perpetuate. And if there's anything that anyone can get out of this webinar today, is that the visual skills necessary for learning go far beyond the ability to see 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm starting to get that.
Yeah.
You mentioned Me Moves. Can you tell
yeah,
us
Me Moves,
more about Me Moves?
It's a program. It's a video program that some occupational therapists, actually quite a few occupational therapists, use to develop a response to the child of general movement, bilaterally controlled movement. Is a very calming and cognitively kind of a awakening kind of program. I don't know how to describe it other than that, in the sense that it's a child sits in front of with the guidance of a therapist, they'll sit in front of a video program or a computer. It's on a DVD. And what they do is they watch the movement of another child or another adult, and they mirror those movements. So they might be moving their arms in a big circle, just around and around and around. And virtually every one of my patients with autism will sit there with the guide of a therapist, and they'll move their arms in the same direction that they see the child facing them move. And it's a really neat program. I think it's very effective and it's very helpful. And it may be, who knows, it may be stimulating that mirror neuron system. In our clinic, we also use, and those of you listening that might be therapists might want to consider trying this, and that is to use a two-way mirror whereby, or a door, a glass door that you can see your own reflection in. And if you're standing on the other side of that door, if you're standing on the other side of that mirror, and you move your body in certain ways, then you're asking your child to move their body in the same way. So they actually see their body inside of your body. Now, you have to get down because you don't want to be their same size, or you get another child to do it. But if they actually see their own body reflected inside of another child's body that they're moving inside of, this is the whole essence of what we call embodied cognition or mirror neurons. And I think that might also, I have no studies on this, it's just an idea that I derived, but it's something that seems to be engaging with children with autism. They're starting to see that their body can move in a way that another child's body moves, and they're actually seeing their body in that child's body, and they're moving in the same way. And I think it's making a connection to the intentions of others, which is the whole concept of the mirror neuron system and possibly some of the challenges that autistic children have.
Are they doing even more studies, I assume, on the reduced number of mirror neurons?
That's an active area of research right now. One of them is, his name is Obermann, and he was the one, he's in cognitive neuroscience, and that's a, he was doing the research to show that even autistic individuals have more mirror neurons over time. And so there was some doubt as to whether or not there was this one-to-one relationship that those with autism have fewer mirror neurons. But so there's a lot of research going on in that. If you were to even, I guess you could Google search mirror neurons and autism, and you'd see a lot of things come up in that area. And the same with embodied cognition. Yeah.
So you can develop more neurons?
Well, that's what people are hoping. That's what Obermann's research seems to indicate, is that you develop more functioning mirror neurons over time. I don't know. Nobody knows, I don't think, if you're actually developing more mirror neurons or you're activating dormant mirror neurons. Nobody's ever been able to do that in a human subject, is to actually, you know, measure mirror neurons directly as they're active. So we don't know for sure what's happening there.
Well,
it's always an indirect finding.
If anybody that's listening via their phone wants to ask a question, please press star 2 and I will see your hand raised. And you're also welcome to submit your questions through the website. I also pulled up your website, Doctor, and I went to the Optometrist Network somehow, but I was looking down through here, and there's a vision quiz on the third page of your website, and I didn't do very well with my quiz.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of fun, though, to think about. It's not something that we often stop to think about, is, you know, just something as simple as vision is learned, true or false.
Yeah, vision is something absolutely is learned, because we have, when we're born, we have primitive reflexes that obligate the body to move. So the moment that gravity kicks in after we're born, these primitive reflexes cause the body to move, and that movement is what enables the child to even realize they have a body. And as the visual system observes the body's movement through space, the child realizes that they can actually, they are an agent in that space. They can actually do things and cause things to change and to move. And they're watching their hand touch something, and they feel something at the same time. So they might grab a ball, and they feel the ball. They have proprioceptive awareness of the ball. They taste the ball. They smell the ball. They let go of the ball. They see the ball rolls. They can hear the ball rolling. And so they're matching all of these sensory systems. And that is only when vision can effectively develop. So without that multisensory experience of interaction in the world, vision, the light coming into the eyes has no meaning. And so there is no meaning out there until we derive meaning from it. And the only way we can derive meaning from our world is by interacting with it physically. And that's why the movement system of the body is so critical. Hence the whole interest in mirror neurons and embodied cognition, because our body is the aspect that enables us to think ultimately, and vision is the one that guides that interaction into being able to think of higher and more abstract areas. So vision's absolutely learned. We don't see 20/20 eyesight till we're about 6 months old, maybe 4 to 6 months old. And we develop depth perception around that same amount of time. And that just happens to be the time when a child is able to start to scoot up onto their knees and sit up and interact bimanually in their environment to actually nurture that three-dimensional vision. So when some of these milestones are skipped, some of the motor milestones are skipped, some of the crawling is skipped and they go right to walking, or they didn't sit down very long, or they're not on their stomach very long, or they're put in walkers too frequently, or they're carried around in buckets or strollers too much of the time, then their body doesn't have an opportunity to learn how to contend with gravity, doesn't have an opportunity to initiate movement itself through space. And we know through lots of research that when the body is moved through space instead of the individual initiating their own movement through space, there's significant difficulty with spatial awareness and confidence in space. Now, they've done this with other mammals, but they've also seen correlates to children in orphanages where they just simply don't understand the space around them because they've never been able to move very much. So movement is what enables us to know where we are in space, to feel confident with where we are in space. That confidence ultimately enables us to see and interact with all the things around us. That leads to confidence and security, which ultimately leads into the freedom to think abstract thoughts without having to worry about your physical environment. So there's a whole progression of things that occurs there, and it's all learned. And when the environment's minimalized or the neurology of the system isn't sufficiently there for an individual to explore the space around them, it can cause significant delays in perception and thinking and social interaction. It just goes on and on. Yeah.
My own son has, he does that looking out of the corners of his eyes at his iPad or the TV.
Mm-hmm.
He's just now, he's 14, and he's just now starting to read.
Great.
But I've taken him to what I thought was developmental peds or developmental optometrist and had his, you know, vision checked because of the what they call visual stimming, looking out of the corners of his eyes.
Was he shaking things or moving things?
No, he doesn't seem to do that.
Okay.
But he's just, it's almost as if he can't focus straight on. He has to turn his head to the side to look at it out of the corner of his eyes, and he'll really, like, concentrate when he's doing that, and he's looking very intently at whatever the object is.
Yeah.
Like, as almost as if he's confused.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I take him to what I think is a developmental optometrist to have him evaluated, and I walk out with the, he's got 20/20 vision, and he's fine.
Yeah.
That was probably 2 years ago, and he's still doing it. And he's had migraines since he was three.
Wow.
And they just can't, I won't say they can't find the source of the migraines. They haven't looked.
Okay.
You know, they've ruled out, you know, food sensitivities and all that kind of thing. But it's just one of those things like, yeah, you have migraines. So I'm now curious as to whether any of this has to do with his visual, you know, issues.
Yeah. Well, it could be, you know, when there's two things that you brought up. One is looking out of the corner of his eyes, and the other is the migraines. And they might be related. They might not be. But many, many children, as you well know, look out of the corner of their eyes to study things or to look at things intently. And nobody is certain about this, but I think what's happening is that children want an extreme proprioceptive knowledge of where their eyes are relative to their body. So just like some children hyperextend their limbs or they constrict their limbs in a way that lets them know where their body is. Just like when we stretch or when we put our, when we move to the extreme of a range of motion of a body part, we know where that body part is because it's not in the middle of the range, it's at the end of the range. So when we're stretching, we know, if we're trying to touch our toes, we know that's where everything is. Now, because we can't go any further. So when you look out of the corner of your eye, you know where your eyes are relative to your head is because it can't go any further. And there's a sense of stability there, I think. There's a sense of orientation, knowing where your body is, where your head is, where your eyes are, to then know where and what something else is. Now that's one possibility of looking out of the corner of the eye, that is to be at such an extreme range to have confidence in knowing where the eyes are, the head are, the body is, and what the thing you're looking at is, where everything is. another reason why, though, some children, I think, look out of the corner of their eyes, because if we all try that now and you look to the extreme corner of your eyes, some of us are going to see double vision. Some of us might see a little blurrier. Some of us might see a little clearer. It's definitely a strain because you're at your extreme range of motion, but it could be a form of stimming in a sense where if there is double vision, then there might be, that might be what they're doing is actually stimming.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another possibility. In terms of migraine, oh, by the way, sometimes yoga prisms can help that too, because we put children's eyes in a lateral gaze and yet have them still see straight ahead with yoga prisms, and that can sometimes satisfy them in terms of that movement. In terms of migraines, sometimes what happens in migraines is that there's something called cortical hyperexcitability in the occipital lobe and some of the pathways that move forward from occipital lobe into temporal lobe and other aspects of the brain. And this cortical hyperexcitability is due to, as you probably know, flickering lights, patterns in the visual environment, and sometimes just bright light. And so some people are doing work with tinted lenses. And you might have heard about tinted lenses in terms of scotopic sensitivity syndrome for children with learning issues such as dyslexia, that you also might have heard about tinted lenses for those with acquired brain injury, and they're also looking at this for individuals with migraine. Mm-hmm. So there have been many individuals that have had what's called colorimetry testing. It's testing using a very specific instrument out of England that provides an opportunity for individuals to experience a full spectrum of wavelengths of different hues and saturations and attenuations to determine what might be most soothing to the neurology of their visual system so as to subdue any induced hyper or cortical hyperexcitability that might lead to or be the precursor of a migraine. Because strobe lights, patterned wallpaper, patterned carpets, flickering lights through trees, televisions, you know, that are in between stations that used to flicker, things like that would typically induce seizures sometimes. And what's thought, migraines are thought sometimes to be a form of a seizure. So it could be that maybe a tinted lens might help that in some way.
This is a problem for me because when I go into doctor's offices and I start spouting things like cortical hyperexcitability, they think I know what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
And it gets me into trouble.
Well, I mean, you can certainly say that you've heard discussions about cortical hyperexcitability and it's really nothing other than cortical hyperexcitability, meaning the cortex is getting too excited with the input that's coming in and the nerves are firing in an uncontrolled way because it can't filter the information coming in very easily and it sets up a pattern that cascades into a formal migraine or a seizure. And that's really all there is to it. So certainly getting rid of unusual pattern or flickering objects in the environment would provide possibly some relief and or maybe a tinted lens or getting rid of the fluorescent lights that might be in his environment, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Not only fluorescent lights from the ceiling, but reflected light off of the surfaces of objects that can act as a strobe light can sometimes induce that. And this is because you've ruled out of the more typical things like allergies to foods, unusual vapors in the environment, and things of that nature.
Do you see any issues with the new light bulbs?
Yes. Well, only because of the mercury, from my opinion.
Right.
I just don't like light bulbs breaking around in our environment with mercury in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the flicker rate of those ice cream cone-like fluorescent bulbs
right.
are supposed to be so fast that you don't see really the cycling that you might see in an otherwise regular tubular bulb, fluorescent bulb.
Hmm.
But the color rendering is very poor, and our visual system is very, very sensitive to color. And I think that, you know, being in an environment that's simply provided by those fluorescent lights, I think is diminishing the full spectrum of light that I think our bodies and visual system really should be experiencing. And I don't think it's probably a good thing. I think a more full spectrum bulb is probably a better way to go. I don't have any proof of that or scientific studies to show that, but I think it just kind of makes sense to me.
Do you like those simulated sunlight lamps?
The lamps that are designed for seasonal affective disorder?
Sometimes they're used for that, but I was talking more of the, you know, you just use them for reading or...
Oh, yeah.
Like
the Ott light, OTT.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, those are very good, I think, too. Now, but again, it's very individualized. I think that some people would prefer a warm white bulb or a soft white bulb or a reveal bulb, cool white. There's different, you know, we all have different genetic makeups, and I think we all come from different parts of the world, and there could be a relationship between the light that we are comfortable in and the light that we're obligated to be in. And so I wouldn't say that one light is best for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Just like certain foods aren't good for everybody, even though there might be quote-unquote healthy foods, they should be quote-unquote healthy for everybody. There might be the same thing with light. I know I feel a lot different in certain kinds of light compared to other kinds of light. And I think kids feel the same way, too. And so I typically suggest to parents that they go to Home Depot and they buy 4 different kinds of light bulbs, warm white, soft white, cool white, the reveal light, maybe a full spectrum light of maybe 50, 100 watt, 150 watt bulbs, and replace the bulbs once a week and see if the behavior changes. I mean, it's not a very expensive investment to do the experiment. And if you find that, gosh, you know, the warm white bulb of 150 watts in his room or in the family room or wherever you are seems to have them be really relaxed, that's the way to go. And you might discover that the cool white bulbs are just horrible. He hates being in there. He doesn't like it. He feels uncomfortable. He's getting more headaches. Then certainly you don't want to use those. So I think that it's worthwhile doing a lighting experiment to find out more about an individual's response to the light around them. Again, you know, 2/3 of all the nerves that come into our brain comes from our eyes, and our eyes are designed to detect light. And that light, the quality of the light that comes in, the volume of the light that comes in, the patterns of the light that comes in, I think makes a significant difference in our ability to think or the comfort that we have in that environment. I think it can go a long way. So I think it's a worthwhile thing to try.
Amy from North Carolina also asks, is there a difference in vision issues who are high sensory seeking? So is there a difference in vision issues for children who are high sensory seeking than those who may not be high sensory seeking?
I don't know. I haven't seen a correlation there personally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's all kinds of sensory seeking, of course. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think sensory seeking is vestibular. Most kids exhibit vestibular sensory seeking, proprioceptive sensory seeking, tactual sense. These are all different senses that I'm listing here.
Yeah.
So it might be that. Some kids are very visual sensory seeking, meaning that they just love to watch the ticker tape thing going along the bottom of a newscast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're watching TV and they have that little scrolling information on the bottom. Well, they'll stare at that for hours. That's visual sensory seeking. The vestibular sensory seeking, of course, is jumping, trampoline, spinning. And tactual would be wanting to be held tightly, you know, to be snuggled up tightly and feeling that proprioceptive joint compression. It just depends on the sensory seeking that's involved, but I don't know per se, if there's a correlative visual problem that's associated with generalized sensory seeking.
Okay. I was looking on your website, too, about vision therapy. Can you explain a little bit about what that might entail? Someone was coming in for vision therapy.
Well, vision,
you know, based on their diagnosis, right?
Sure, yeah. You know, determining what challenges a child might have, what developmental delays they might have in vision, it might initially turn out that they really have a deficit in vestibular development, so we would want to work on that first, possibly with an occupational therapist or a physical therapist. But if we know that everything seems to be okay in that regard, we're going to now look at visual development in regards to visual perception or visual binocularity or depth perception or scanning or focusing, then what we'll do is design a program where a child comes in once a week for an hour and works one-on-one with us for that hour. And we engage in about 4 to 6 different activities during that hour to nurture the development of whatever deficient skills we find. We make it fun, of course. We make it meaningful to the parent's goals. And if the child comes up with a goal, we can do that. But we're always integrating vestibular function, auditory function, visual function, all the different senses that we've been talking about, to ensure that the visual system has a coherent interaction with all those systems to guide the intelligent movement of the body, to begin to discriminate the perceptual aspects of their environment. And we give activities at home as well. So we would give possibly the Me Moves program, maybe the multi-matrix game program, maybe a tracking tube, possibly a Marsden ball, to have the parents engage them at home on a daily basis to whatever extent they can. And this course of action might take anywhere from 4 months to 2 years, depending on the depth of the challenge and the development of the child and the goals that are established. But it's usually one-on-one. Sometimes it's two therapists on one child, just because of the nature of the child. They're very active, or they have short attention span, or they are, you know, real reticent to engage in activities. And so we try to nurture that relationship and that engagement as best we can.
Do your therapists have any behavioral training, such as ABA?
They don't typically have ABA training. We have knowledge of ABA, and we have knowledge of different behavioral modification programs. We consult with others that are trained in that area, so that we are consistent with what they are currently doing, so as to not be disruptive in what they're trying to learn and develop. So, no, we're not ABA trained, but we do consult with ABA therapists to make sure that we're on par or doing, we're consistent with what's being done at the time. Yeah.
Okay. Well, looking through your website here, success with learning disabilities. I like this whole area of your website here because people can go in and pull up different, possible learning difficulties, possible visual difficulties, and kind of see how they relate to one another.
Uh-huh. That's right. There's a relationship between those two. Between, you're talking about the behaviors and the possible
mm-hmm.
visual problems. For example, if a child loses their place when they're trying to read, it could be that they have a saccadic difficulty, meaning they simply can't move their eyes when and where they want to in order to follow along a line of print. And there's some nice tests that are given in that area. For example, we would do what's called infrared electroencephalography or infrared visuoscopy or electrooculography to monitor the eyes as they're reading along a line of print in order for us to know if they can, in fact, move their eyes accurately, and when they do move them, how much information are they gathering per fixation. So there's some very sophisticated ways that we do it, but there's also some very good clinical ways that we can do that, too, with what's called the developmental eye movement test, for example. It's an excellent test of determining whether or not a child can move their eyes when and where they want to. And in the perceptual realm, if they can't remember what they read, or they can't relate what they read with things they already know, or they can't manipulate a pencil or construct with their hands, a really great test is called the WAX analysis of cognitive structure. So we can use that. It's called the WACS, the WAX analysis of cognitive structure, and that's given by many people in COVD to, and it's specifically designed for children along the autistic spectrum to measure movement, perception, visually guided movement. It's a wonderful test. So we can tease out, is this behavior because of a lack of academic development? Is it a lack of visual development? Could it be a lack of language development? And as we rule these things out and we refer to other professionals to help us understand that more completely, then we see that there's a visual piece left, then we can work on that visual piece and help them develop that skill.
It had never occurred to me that toe walking could be a visual issue.
Yeah, toe walking, even leaning to one side, walking along the side of a wall, anything that they don't seem to be spatially confident in or spatially balanced in. The parietal lobe of our brain is very closely related to judging the space around us, and that parietal lobe is very sensitive to shifts in the optics that are put in front of the eyes. So when we put yoked prisms in front of anyone's eyes, you'll see a spatial shift, and your body will reflexively move in or out of midline. And when the body moves in and out of midline, either forward, back, or left and right, you're either more balanced or less balanced in relationship to the space around you. And so, it's a significant issue. When we see children either toe walking, leaning left, leaning right, and sometimes even have a tendency to fall backwards, we can sometimes address that by shifting how they perceive their space, which results in how they shift their body. There's a one-to-one correlation there. We see it all the time in acquired brain injury. I had a pilot two days ago who had a brain tumor removed from his right parietal lobe, and it resulted in him not being able to walk in a straight line. So we put yoke prisms on him, and he walks in a straight line. It's mm-hmm. as simple as that. Yeah.
Enlighten me. What do yoke prisms look like?
They might not look any different than anyone else's glasses.
Oh.
They're not necessarily super thick or unusual looking in any way. If you look at them carefully, you might notice that they're a little thicker on one edge rather than the other. But by and large, they don't look any different than anyone else's glasses.
Huh.
Yeah.
Do they make the eyes look any different when you're looking at the person?
Nope.
Nope?
Nope.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, they're just glasses, but they are a specific prescription to shift the world in a different place so as to cause the body to move in a different way.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't believe what I had in my mind, what that looks like.
Mr. Magoo or
yes. would you like to tell people what your website is called and how they can reach you if they have more questions?
I don't have my website memorized, actually.
Really?
Do you have it there?
I'm on it.
Okay.
If it's not a link through this one, this is your actual website, it's optometrists.org /San_Diego.
Okay. Yeah. Or you could even just Google or Bing my name, Carl Hillier.
Mm-hmm.
And my website will also come up there.
That's what I kind of did. That's
yeah.
Uh-huh.
My email is Z as in Victor, therapy. So it's ztherapy@pacbell.net.
So the V must stand for vision.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Therapy at yeah. Pacbell, PACBELL.net.
Right. And my phone number is 619-464-7713.
And all this is on his website as well, his email link and his phone number and address and lots of information. It'd take me a couple hours to go through all this, but I love reading the success stories.
Good. Yeah, it's always fulfilling to have that be the end result.
Yeah. And you have a